from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Nature and the Self in Modern Literature, this week on Soundings. My guests are two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. First on this edition of Soundings, a discussion with Eugene Goodhart of Brandeis University about his cultural study of the self. Following that, a conversation with Carl Woodring of Columbia University about his work on nature and art in 19th century English literature. According to Eugene Goodhart, two important modern conceptions of the self derive from the psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud and the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. Here is Eugene Goodhart.
Well, certainly Freud was interested in the fact that people were neurotic. In fact, he invented he sponsored the word neurosis. He gave it a kind of prestige that it didn't have before his time.
Meaning what? Not well?
Not well. Ill, right. And that in order to understand the illness of a person, you had a conception of a person, what makes for health, what makes for illness. And I think probably the central concept in the Freudian view is the concept of repression, a notion that people have energies, libidinous energies that are repressed, that can't express themselves in a direct and in a full way, and that's the source of human illness. Now, there's a variety of ways in which people are repressed, variety of ways in which they displace those energies, in which they sublimate the energies, in which they repress the energies, and I think what's happened in the contemporary period, and it could be maybe traced back to the middle of the 19th century, but I think what happens in the contemporary period, it becomes almost ideological in certain quarters, is a sense that maybe unity, coherence, wholeness are repressive terms. Maybe that's part of the whole story of repression, and that what you have to do is reconceive the self and think in terms of opposites, like fragmentariness, inchoateness, discontinuity. In other words, free the self to be a multiplicity, a diversity, and not worry about wholeness, coherence, and unity.
All right. To what end? To find what?
The end of freedom.
To find some deeper harmony or coherence? Or?
Well, I think the value terms there would be liberation, freedom, to achieve a certain kind of freedom, a kind of free play of energy.
All right. And here we have, if I follow you correctly, Gene Goodhart, here we are on to what, the ideological level or dimension, if not overtly political. Yeah. Am I following you
well,
properly?
Yeah. There is a kind of paradox here because, again, if we go back to Plato and we think of reason, passions, the appetites as the three principal faculties of individual life, and that reason should be the dominant faculty and should subordinate the passions and the appetites. If you can imagine a situation in which now you declare the passions and the appetites should rule, because that's where human life is, and if you can translate the passions and the appetites to a word like desire, a desire should rule. The desire is the all-encompassing category. In fact, Dostoevsky says in Notes from Underground that everything is desire, and that even reason is encompassed by desire. Reason, scratching yourself, being lazy, being active, everything is an expression of desire. And that becomes not simply a description of what human beings are, but a value, something to be realized and fulfilled.
A program for human behavior.
That's right. So my argument is that there is a complexity to human life in which those traditional categories of reason, desire, or what used to be called the passions and the appetites, all have a role. And for me, ideology enters when one of those terms is excessively valued, when it's universalized, when it becomes the supreme value. And here I would go back to Nietzsche, who is in some way the hero of my argument, because what Nietzsche argued was that individuals are all different from one another. And the important thing is for an individual to discover the principle of his being. Mm-hmm. He may be essentially a rational animal. He may be a desiring animal. He may be an ascetic animal. And that it's a desecration of life to take one value, and like desire or reason, and universalize it, make it a categorical imperative for everybody.
I see. Let's strike an example, Gene Goodhart, halfway, help me with the chronology, halfway between Nietzsche on the one hand and these more recent writers that you've cited, and that is Joseph Conrad. That may be a sort of a familiar name, and the story, for example, Heart of Darkness. What's going on in that story with respect to your conceptions of self, reason, desire? I mean, it's a, here's a tall order, but this is a wonderful story about a descent into what he calls the heart of darkness. Just explain that to me.
Well, it's a complicated story. It's hard to know where where to begin. But let me begin with the character of Kurtz. You recall Kurtz, who is one of the two main characters in the story. The story is told by Marlowe, and it's a story of a journey into the African jungle, into the Congo, in which he's going to meet this magical character, Kurtz. And Kurtz is a man from Belgium. He's a European, and he is somebody who is how is he characterized? He's characterized as a rational man, as a man who believes in progress, in science, in pity, in compassion. And he's going to come to the African jungle, and he's going to bring light where there is darkness, and he's going to civilize the natives and so on. And of course, the irony of the story is that he's completely overthrown by the forces of darkness. He's consumed, but he's destroyed. He's degraded. He becomes the most
savage
character in the story. It's unspeakable what he does, the rites he performs, the rites of degradation.
Who is it who says the horror
in fact this
awful thing?
He says the horror,
he said about himself
and it's a moment of redemption, because he sees what he has become. And so you have to understand the process by which he became that. And there, of course, a lot of people have interpreted that story, and there are different interpretations. My view of the story is that his degradation is the result of his excessive rationalism. I mean, you can connect it with the Freudian view of the concept of repression.
And it isn't
the return of the repressed.
Yeah, and it's not that rationalism by itself is a villain. It's the fact that as a value, it has taken precedence over these other.
That an extreme, excessive claim has been made for it, and Kurtz does not show a respect for those dark energies.
Are we back, Gene Goodhart, to something as simple and perhaps pure and innocent as the notion that moderation in everything is a good idea?
Well, if we stay with Heart of Darkness, I mean, one could read that's a possible morality to read out of, for instance, the character of Marlowe, who has achieved a kind of accommodation between reason and the forces of energy, but the dark energies. But he's not satisfied with that accommodation. He feels a kind of inadequacy in his own life. My answer to it is that I mean moderation is a value. I'm not saying it isn't a value, but I'm not simply interested in moderation. For instance, I'll go back to the Nietzschean argument. There are people who are passionate about something. That's the principle of their beings. They should be allowed to unfold the principle of their passion, whatever it is. I mean, to unfold their passion, whatever that is. There are people who are rationalists, you know, who live a life of the mind. They should be allowed to unfold the life of the mind to the fullest extent. That is not that's not moderation. It's imposing your values on others.
But
that's anathema to me.
One reaction to this, Gene Goodhart, might be to say that you sound like you are profoundly anti-religion or religionist, or at least you are you do not want in this opposition to an imposition of one value upon many individuals.
Right.
Aren't we going to go in so many fragmented, different, crazy directions that there is going to be no such thing as a social consensus, and we're back after a fashion to the law of the jungle?
The characteristic objection to this view is that it's a form of relativism.
All right, well, respond to that for me.
Yeah. What I'm interested in really is individual life and an idea of liberty, which makes it possible for people to unfold their individualities to the fullest extent. And in fact, the argument, I mean, just to mention another figure who made that argument, John Stuart Mill, an essay on liberty. But I believe also that you cannot even begin to do that unless you exist in, unless you have a kind of common understanding and a respect for common decency. So, for instance, there are certain qualifications. I do not believe that people should harm one another.
Yeah.
I do not believe that people should kill one another. So there is a common morality.
Yeah, but now, Gene, let me challenge on this. You sound like you don't believe in original sin. You sound like you think that people are really good enough inside themselves that if we just trust them and let them trust their instincts, that bingo, we're going to have maybe a variegated and an unpredictable society, but we're going to have one that's essentially harmonious. Now, are you going to sit across the table from the Russians or, I don't know, whoever you want to pick as the other guy, the villain, the other, the enemy, and tell me that kind of thing is going to work? Help me to understand that your argument in those terms.
Well, I'm agnostic on the question of original sin. I'm not a Christian, so I don't believe. But I know that's not the question you're asking.
No.
You're really asking the question whether I believe that evil exists in the world. And if I did believe that evil exists in the world, wouldn't I be concerned with the ways in which one controls evil? And I could think of another conversation which we'd have in which that would be a concern. But I'm really not interested in that question in thinking about
the
book that I'm writing.
Because that involves too much of a judgmental kind of an approach, and you are interested more in a descriptive kind of thing?
No. I think I'm interested. I'm talking now as a moralist. I'm talking as a moralist for individuality, for freedom, a moralist against coercion. So I can't say that I'm simply describing. I'm responding to what I think is a phenomenon of modern life, and it's a tendency to ideologize, and in my understanding of ideologize, to universalize certain particular views or particular experiences, make them general, and impose them coercively on others.
It's like
if you want to know what evil is, I think that's evil.
Yeah, excess.
And the important thing is to be yourself and to fulfill your own potentiality, to live out the lines of your own body.
Eugene Goodhart teaches at Brandeis University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Eugene Goodhart worked on a new book about modern conceptions of the self, ideology, and desire. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Modern Literary Culture continues. My guest now is Carl Woodring of Columbia University. During his recent fellowship year at the center, Carl Woodring worked on a new study about nature and art in 19th century English literature. Here is Carl Woodring.
Well, our own definitions, the way in which we use the words nature and art derive from things that happened in the 18th and 19th century. The arts, the fine arts, had not really existed as one thing until fairly late in the 18th century. They talked of sister arts, but no one had any sense of something that they then began to call the beautiful, which was in fine arts. Mm-hmm. And they excluded, perhaps for the first time in the West, moral beauty. It then became something that was beautiful to the senses. So
you're talking not only about what expressive culture in the sense of artists and musicians, you're talking about some feeding in here of philosophical conceptions, for instance.
Oh yes, in the large sense, it's nature, what mankind did not make, mm-hmm. Against art or civilization, which is everything that nature had not done, uh-huh. That then man did to it.
Uh-huh.
That's in the larger sense. But nature, too, the way we use the word, had not really come about in that way before somewhere near 1800. That is, nature meant the basic underlying principle of things. Uh-huh. I say that there's no one person who did as much to bring on the idea of art for art's sake as Charles Darwin.
How is that?
That by demonstrating that that those few people who had felt that you should not follow nature in human conduct were quite right, that the nature, which had been thought so perfectly designed, was in fact, in Darwin's terms, one of natural selection, survival of the fittest, a uh-huh. term that Spencer used. Darwin himself didn't want that. Darwin was a... Herbert Spencer,
right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But it... I myself believe that what Darwin did was not simply to show that you needed more time than Bishop Usher's 4,004 years had allowed, but that the world we have around us has come about by chance, an mm-hmm. accident.
Give me, for example, an instance, early in the 19th century, of an artistic conception of nature. You've talked about Darwin and his view of things as and his influence on artists as it comes a little later in the century.
Well, there's an amazing amount of study by the even the painters, mm-hmm. of what philosophers were saying, of what the poets were doing. Wordsworth was certainly a highly influential writer for people in almost any activity, and he had added to the natural religion a place for emotion and for intuition.
Uh-huh.
The Romantic movement in this sense was made its turn toward the unconscious and toward
his view was what? That nature is a kind of a benevolent and loving force out there beyond one's consciousness, and somehow or other it helps us to be better people. Can we reduce it to something as simple as that?
This is certainly what the Victorians that followed Wordsworth believed he was saying.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's what Wordsworth believed he was saying, too.
Uh-huh.
It's not what all critics today would say one finds in Wordsworth, but that's what he meant to the Victorians. But they had some set terms which they had to deal with, the sublime and the beautiful, and then the picturesque. The picturesque meaning really like a picture,
mm-hmm.
But it was like a picture by Claude Lorraine, Poussin, and then the sublime, which was the horrendous and terrible, the scenery rended by time or disaster, ruins, shipwrecks,
uh-huh.
Mountains also, which were somewhat domesticated in this process.
Think of somebody like Byron in a play like Manfred, that sort of thing. Nature as a threat, are we on the right track there?
Well, in the arts, it was not a threat. It was uh-huh. what was threatening and would create fear, but then there is pleasure in overcoming that fear. There's a pleasure, the pleasure in defeating it, conquering it.
Mm-hmm.
It's something of the problem that had always been there in tragedy. What is it that gives pleasure to an audience in seeing all that blood?
Yeah.
Kant and others were trying to examine the question of what it is that out of this terror can in fact give some sense of exaltation. But those terms were very significant, and the English writers began to speak of the picturesque as something that English landscape had.
No place else? Yeah, when you mean it was exclusively English?
Well, no. For the painters, of course, it had been in Italy.
Oh, I see.
But they did not have Alps. They had mountains.
They had Mount Snowdon.
They had Snowdon. they had the mountains in the Lake Country.
Uh-huh.
But they didn't have that really horrendous, sublime nature. And so the picturesque became something of a national pride, whereas for the Americans, the wilderness and the sublimity came first, something that I've been interested in a long time and had written about with regard to Wordsworth. The historians of American painting have begun to catch on to, and which is that sublime and terrible, the rugged and the fierce, came for Wordsworth to be a sublimity in the quiet of an ordinary, humble human mind, especially one that had been out in nature and was not contaminated by mm-hmm. activities in the city. An American, Thomas Cole, who was the great originator of sublime landscape in the United States, wrote a good deal, wrote more than he painted about the sublimity of silence and quiet. But later landscape painters in this country began to do just that, to show that it is in silence, or it is in calm. Not for a painter, it's harder to show what Wordsworth was saying, that it's in an ordinary, humble mm-hmm. mind, a child, or some inoffensive peasant. First follow nature, and mm-hmm. the nature itself will be uplifting, will be pure. I mean, Wordsworth's first argument in the preface was that the language of shepherds and peasants would be the purest language because they were the closest to the enduring forms of nature.
Mm-hmm.
He modified that later on, but it was something he would like to believe. And by the end of the century, almost everyone agreed with Coleridge that if you went out to a peasant or a shepherd, you find that they try to communicate with grunts primarily.
There's nothing necessarily artistic in all of that.
Yeah. But the extreme of announcing that art had nothing else to serve.
Except itself.
Except itself.
Uh-huh.
Has an obvious connection with the direction that art went in our time toward abstract art, toward art that quite clearly had freed itself of moral content.
Mm-hmm.
But that sense of genius and of the what Whistler would say the superiority of the artist does continue all through the century. So mm-hmm. that whether you regard yourself as a servant and priest and prophet of nature, or whether you're a prophet of art, they really felt that they should never bend to an audience.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of the century, perhaps we have something quite different. There have been a lot of studies of Tennyson and Browning, others feeling the tension between those two, that they'd like to be true to this inner inspiration and to the art that is there in the sound and appeals to the senses, but that they had an obligation to the audience, to the public, to the whole society.
What about today? How do our writers, poets, artists look at this relationship between nature and art? How does it differ markedly from the way these 19th century figures would approach that topic?
Well, I'm not sure that I can make total generalizations about what's going on in our own time. We, I'm happy to say, have a lot of writers flourishing, but of the literature and the art that I'm familiar with, much of it is a protest, with a sense sometimes that it's too late. I mean, the difference between the figures in the 19th century as now is that they were able to say there is still enough of this that we can all feel that we're living in it and learning and drawing strength from it, but giving warnings. And I think the art itself today tends to be about the disaster. I mean, many of the ironic handlings of Oldenburg's
then it was
objects
a kind of
in nature. The pop art generally is in itself a kind of protest against against the turning of the back on those things that were the values of nature.
Carl Woodring is a professor at Columbia University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Carl Woodring worked on a forthcoming study of nature and art in 19th century English literature. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 413. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about Greek philosophy and ethics. My guests will be Philip Mitsis of Cornell University and Jennifer Whiting of the University of Pittsburgh. With this edition, Soundings initiates a new feature, Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The last week in August, in the year 430 AD, marks the death of St. Augustine, author of the Confessions and the City of God. In 1749, the birth of Johann Wolfgang Goethe, the German author and philosopher. In 1774, the birth of Elizabeth Ann Bailey Seton, the first American saint. In 1809, the birth of Oliver Wendell Holmes, the American physician and writer. And in 1893 and 1901, the births of Huey Long, the Louisiana politician, and Roy Wilkins, the civil rights leader. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Partial support for Soundings comes from The Leader, News of the Research Triangle. Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Nature and the Self in Modern Literature. This week on Soundings. Listen for Eugene Goodhart of Brandeis University and Carl Woodring of Columbia University. Eugene Goodhart is the author of a new study entitled Ideology and Desire. Carl Woodring is at work on a new book about nature and art in 19th century England. Nature and the Self, Some Answers and Insights, this week on Soundings.